Okay, let's pray and let's get into it. Father, thank you for your word. Thank you for the Bible, the scriptures, and what it is that you have spoken. And as we read it, we use this word as we read these stories, but they're not just stories. They're stories in that they're historic accounts. These stories actually happens. It's not mythology. It's not legend. These are stories of what happened in people's lives. And as we read about David, as we've been studying him and just some of the terrible, heartbreaking events in his life, and even last week with almost the proverbial straw that broke the camel's back, as Samuel dies and David just went into this funk in so many ways, we're going to see it get worse for him. It gets into despair, and we can relate to this, and we wish we didn't have to relate to it, but we do. And in that sense, we're grateful that you tell us as it is. You tell us what actually happened. You don't sugarcoat any of it. And we can relate to the difficulties of life. Even as we studied on Sunday morning from your word, oh Lord, everyone suffers. And what can we glean from these things? And what can we learn from Saul, King Saul, who was decidedly, unfortunately, against you for so much of his life and so much of his reign. And whatever it is that you might not just speak to us, but Holy Spirit, by way of what you've inspired, the Word of God being inspired of you, what might you speak to us individually concerning application, where we need to be, where we need to be with you. So thank you that we can gather. Thank you for this fellowship and just love Wednesday night. So grateful that we can be here. In Jesus' precious name, amen. All right, chapter 26. Now the Ziphites, they came to Saul at Gibeah saying, "Is David not hiding in the hills of Hachilah opposite Yeshimon?" And then Saul arose and went down to the wilderness of Ziph, having 3,000 chosen men of Israel with him to seek David in the wilderness of Ziph. And Saul encamped in the hill of Hachilah, which is opposite Yeshimon by the road. But David stayed in the wilderness, and he saw that Saul came after him into the wilderness. David, verse 4, therefore sent out spies and understood that Saul had indeed come. This is a little bit weird. A little bit weird from a couple of previous chapters. Didn't we just read that? Didn't Saul say, like, David, my son, you're more, this is chapter 24, you're more righteous than I. You've rewarded me with good, whereas I've rewarded you with evil. You've shown me this day how you've dealt with me. You've been good to me. And therefore, this is chapter 24, verse 20. And now I know indeed that you shall surely be king, and that the kingdom of Israel shall be established in your hand. Therefore, swear now to me by the Lord that you will not cut off my descendants after me, and that you will not destroy my name from my father's house. He's conceding, right? You're such a great man. You're better than I, and you're going to be the king. And please be merciful to my people, my family, when you become king. Almost, this is what, in chapter 24, or chapter 26? A really short-lived ceasefire, and I don't mean that as a funny thing. Like, man, Saul, what happened? He's just so split in his heart and his mind. So David sends out these spies, like, am I really seeing this? Is this really what's happening? And, sir, yes, this is exactly what's happening. So David, verse 5, arose and came to the place where Saul had encamped. And David saw the place where Saul lay, and Abner the son of Ner, the commander of his army. Now Saul lay within the camp with the people encamped all around him. This is an interesting thing, obviously from a practical sense. Like, what's happening? What did we just read in verse 5? Simple. Here's the king in the middle of the camp, right? That practically, that makes sense. Would you agree? Like, it's the king. The army is going to protect the king. So from a practical standpoint, obviously, but this is oh so telling. And it's oh so telling primarily because it's Saul. And like, what else would you expect from Saul other than being right in the middle, right in the center? For Saul, everything centered around him. Soldiers, you will give your lives protecting me. When you read about David, he didn't seem to conduct himself that way. When I think about my Jesus, he didn't conduct himself that way. Giving of himself, laying down his life for his own. Interesting, but this is Saul. Verse 6, Then David answered and said to Ahimelech the Hittite and to Abishai the son of Zeruiah, brother of Joab, or Joab, saying, "Who will go down with me to Saul in the camp?" And Abishai said, "I will go down with you." So he's kind of looking for some volunteers. He's recruiting some people. Abishai decides that he'll go with David. Another just great thing with David, we like to say this. You guys know that I work with the Rogers Band program, and one of the funny turns of the English language that we like to employ is not a volunteer, but being voluntold, right? Like, I need a volunteer, and that happens to be you, right? It's like, but that's not so with David. It's, would anyone like to go with me? And Abishai says, yeah, I'll go with you. So David, verse 7, and Abishai came to the people by night, and there Saul lay sleeping within the camp with his spear, don't miss that, his trusty spear, stuck in the ground by his head, and Abner and the people lay all around him. Verse 8, now Abishai said to David, "God has delivered your enemy into your hand this day. Now therefore, please, let me strike him at once with the spear right to the earth, and I will not have to strike him a second time." That's like the, what's the old, there's two hits, me hitting you, you hitting the ground. Kind of, this is like, it's going to, just one thrust of the spear, sir, is all I need for this. And I wonder what's going through David's mind at this point. This is Saul's spear. Like, this is a really telling kind of a thing. Not that it represents something in our Christian lives. I'm not suggesting that. But just from David's standpoint, what memories would that have triggered in his mind? That spear that's been chucked at me a handful of times, stuck in the wall, and now it's stuck in the ground, and like, they sneak into the camp like, here he is. And Abishai says pretty much what they said a couple chapters ago. When Saul goes into the cave to attend to his needs, I think is what the New King James says, and attend to his needs, and the Lord brought him. You can just take him out and we'll be done with this. But I can't touch the Lord's anointed, was David's response. And here the second time, Abishai, the same message, just kill him. Just kill him. And this is justification, right? This would be justified in that he promised to leave you be, and yet here he is, he's chasing after you, and the Lord has brought him to you. And he volunteers. You don't even have to do it, sir. Doesn't it have to be a death by your hand? I'll kill him for you. And what's David thinking at this point? We don't know. But there's probably a compelling enough thought in his head to consider it, except verse 9 says, but. So if we're just to kind of sit there on verse 8 and imagine what David might think, we're told, verse 9, but David said to Abishai, "Do not destroy him. Why? For who can stretch out his hand against the Lord's anointed and be guiltless? Who can do that? God put this man in power. God put this man in this position." David said, "Therefore, as the Lord lives, the Lord shall strike him, or his day shall come to die, or he shall go out to battle and perish. The Lord forbid that I should stretch out my hand against the Lord's anointed. But please, Abishai, take now the spear and the jug of water that are by his head, and let's go, let's get out of here. It is not my place to do this work of God. God is perfectly capable of handling his own people. You should kill him. You're going to be the king anyways. It is not my place to do that." This is a righteous man, David is. And even all the terrible things that have befallen him and some of the terrible decisions that he's made, yet he knows, he recognizes the position of the Lord and the authority of the Lord in and over his life, and how frustrating that might have been, because it's been, for us, chapters and chapters since he was anointed king. And like, well, when's it my turn? It's not your turn. Well, no, I know that, but when? Because you told me it would be. It's not your turn. But Saul is the... Yes. That's my guy. That's the king. Well, I could just... David, you could... Abishai, no. Just kill him. One... No. No. So let's get out of here. David, verse 12, he took the spear, the jug of water by Saul's head, and they got away, and no man saw, this is interesting, saw or knew it or awoke. Why? For they were all asleep, because a deep sleep from the Lord had fallen on them. Like, because this is pretty impressive. We're like just tiptoe through the entire camp. And how many was it? 3,000 or 6,000 people that are there. And Saul in the middle. Like, seriously? Like, the older I get, the more often in the middle of the night, I might need to wake up in the middle of the night. You know, like nobody just kind of, what are those two guys doing over by the king? Like, I'll just go, like, this is the Lord. This is the Lord that puts this sleep on these men, all of them. Now David went over to the other side and stood on the top of a hill afar off, a great distance being between them. And David called out to the people and to Abner the son of Ner, saying, "Do you not answer, Abner?" Then Abner answered and said, "Who are you calling out to the king?" So David said to Abner, "Are you not a man? And who is like you in Israel? Why then have you not guarded your lord the king? For one of the people came in to destroy your lord the king. This thing that you have done is not good." He's poking at Abner here a little bit. "It's not good what you've done. As the Lord lives, you deserve to die because you've not guarded your master, the Lord's anointed. And now see where the king's spear is. Go ahead and take a second and look for it, Abner, if you want to do that. And the jug of water that was by his head." Then Saul, verse 17, knew David's voice. "And is that your voice? Who? My son David?" Because technically he's, well, Michal, Saul's daughter, was given to another person, but this is, or had been, his father-in-law. "Is that you, my son? My son David?" David said, "It's my voice, O Lord, O King." I can just sit on that for a second. One thing to call him Lord out of respect, but King? I've been appointed king. It's my time. But it's the Lord's anointed. And the humility, and the vocal humility. The difficulty perhaps sometimes with our Bible study and reading even this. So the genre here, of course, is narrative. We're reading a story, reading a historical account. One of the difficulties, of course, in any text, especially the Bible text, we're not provided any tone. Does he give the air quotes? I don't know if they're ancient Hebrew air quotes, you know, but like, "my king," like you're, as though you're really the, because we both know and everyone knows you're not really the king. But I don't think he says it that way. I think it's a true, genuine honoring him as king because he was the king. Thus, his conversation with Abishai and the guys earlier in the previous chapters with the cave, he's still the king. I might not care for him, but the Lord put him in place. And oh, this might be some conversations for us living in yet another election. Not my president, but this is your president. Because, oh, by the way, we the people speak and we appoint, and we'll get to this when we get to this in the book of Romans, but the Lord appoints people into position. And David recognizes this. He recognizes the Lord and the Lord's sovereignty. He says, it's my voice, O Lord, O King. And he said, verse 18, "Why does my Lord thus pursue his servant? For what have I done, or what evil is in my hand?" Like, he's reminding Saul, "You've already said such things. Now, therefore, please let my lord the king hear the words of his servant. If the Lord has stirred you up against me," if this is the Lord's doing, "let him accept an offering. But if it's the children of men, may they be cursed before the Lord, for they have driven me out this day from sharing in the inheritance of the Lord, saying, 'Go serve other gods.'" This is actually an interesting kind of phrase that David uses here at the tail end of this speech that he sends to Saul. What is he confessing? You get the sense that he had considered along the way, considered abandoning both Israel and the God of Israel entirely. Like, people are saying, "You should go serve something else. You should go do something else. This is not, this whole following God is not working for you." Never have people in your life? Like, you go on Sundays all the time and you go on Wednesdays? Man, this, it's a little weird. Maybe this is a little extreme. Maybe you should go find something else to do. And it sounds like, where is David in this? They've driven me out this day from sharing the inheritance of the Lord, saying, go serve other gods, go serve other Elohim. So now, verse 20, do not let my blood fall to the earth before the face of the Lord, for the king of Israel has come out to seek a flea, as when one hunts a partridge in the mountains. It's, oh king, please just leave me be. I am no threat. I mean you no harm, as evidenced a few chapters ago by your robe. Cut off a little corner of it. I could have killed you. Here's your spear. Here's your water jug. I've never meant you any harm. I've had opportunity to remove your breath from your lungs. And yet here you are. Please, O king, just stop this madness. Then Saul said, I've sinned. Return, my son David, for I will harm you no more, because my life was precious in your eyes this day. Indeed, I have played the fool and have erred exceedingly. There in verse 21, this is an interesting statement from Saul. Some commentators have labeled that last statement of his, indeed, I have played the fool and erred exceedingly. That is the statement that summarizes basically his entire rule. And he's recognizing it. And David answered verse 22 and said, here's the king's spear. Let one of the young men come over and get it. And may the Lord repay every man for his righteousness and his faithfulness, for the Lord delivered you into my hand today. Interesting that he says it that way. But I would not stretch out my hand against the Lord's anointed. And indeed, as your life was valued much this day in my eyes, so let my life be valued much in the eyes of the Lord, and let him deliver me out of all tribulation. I'm committing myself, my life, my very breath into the Lord's hand, and I'm trusting in his mercy and his provision. Then Saul said to David, may you be blessed, my son David. You shall both do great things and also still prevail. So David went on his way, and Saul returned to his place. Again, unfortunately, if you're David, probably what are you thinking? This is this uneasy peace treaty where there's the right words from Saul. You know, this is some kind of recognition of his error, of his sin, of his foolishness, but it doesn't seem to be true repentance, even though he admits to being such a foolish man. It's just, like Ricky and I were talking about this before the study, you know, so much to learn from David and so much to learn from Saul. Like, I want to just be like David when he's doing great things, not be like David when he's being a knucklehead. And unfortunately, so much of Saul is exactly this. Well, I've played the fool. I've erred exceedingly. That's been his lot in life, and his decision-making prowess has provided that. And so much to learn from the mistakes of others. Isn't that how that works? Two ways to learn something: from your own mistakes or from someone else's mistakes. Our pride tends to say, well, I'll never do that. And okay, well, then you are fast-forwarding. You are well on your way to making those same mistakes, even though you think you're never going to make those mistakes. And now you're going to learn from their mistakes and your own mistakes. Like, just learn from their mistakes, right? I mean, do the math there. It checks out. Chapter 27, and David said in his heart, put that into context, have you ever talked to yourself? Speaking to your own heart, speaking in your own mind, and it's even a whole other side note, isn't it? I'm trusting that you're Bible students and you've read through the book of Psalms. How often does David talk to himself? Just, oh my soul, don't be, why are you disquieted within me? Like, hope thou in the Lord. Like, David, who's your audience? Me. Christy's always worried about me, not when I talk to myself, but when I answer myself, you know. But so David, as you should be, I suppose, right? But David said in his heart, and listen to what he says, now I shall perish someday by the hand of Saul. There's some conviction to that. What do I mean by conviction? You've probably heard me discuss this kind of thing before, where faith and unbelief have a great thing in common. Both faith and unbelief are convinced that certain things are true. Faith would say, I believe what God has said. Unbelief would say, I know what he said, but I believe something differently, right? This conviction, he is assured of this in his very own heart, the depth of his soul. Now I will perish someday probably not today, might be tomorrow, but eventually, I know God, this is the statement, right? I know God promised me the kingdom, but actually Saul's going to kill me. The king's going to kill me before I get to be king. He's convinced. You got to understand just where David is in this. And he says, there is nothing better for me than that I should speedily escape to the land of the Philistines? That's the land of the enemy, isn't it? Because if I do that, he says, Saul will despair of me. Or some of your translations might even say despair of searching for it. What does that mean? He'll just give up. He'll quit the pursuit. If I'm over there, he's not going to chase me there. He'll despair of me to seek me anymore in any part of Israel. So I shall escape out of his hand. There's great power. Follow this. There's great power in hope. And unfortunately, there's great power in hopelessness. Much the same way that guilt is both a wonderful and a terrible motivator. Hopelessness is a powerful but a terrible motivator. There's great power in it. And the power of what we say in our hearts, what we say to ourselves, what we believe in our hearts, he really apparently believes this. Why do I say that? Because his actions, as we're going to read in just a moment, will prove that he believes this to be true. Sometimes we say things in our hearts, and then like the next moment, snap out of itself, like it's not that bad, you know. Like this is Sunday morning, like, everyone suffers, but really, not everything is terrible in life. I was having a chat with a friend of mine today. There's the general grace of God to everyone. It's a nice sunny day today. You know, if you're a non-believer, you weren't in a violent rainstorm just in pockets throughout the city, like the people walking around in the sunshine. That must be a Christian because the rest of us are suffering. That doesn't work that way. Like there's general blessings to everyone. But he believes. No. He believes. He doesn't snap out of this. He believes and therefore he acts. Then, verse 2, he arose and went over with the 600 men who were with him to Achish, the son of Maok, the king of Gath. We've read about this before. So David dwelt with Achish at Gath, he and his men, each man with his, notice verse 3, his household, and David with his two wives, Ahinoam the Jezreelitess and Abigail the Carmelitess, Nabal's widow. And so it was told Saul that David had fled to Gath. And so, verse 4, what? He sought him no more. What does that mean? It means David was right. If I go over here, he'll stop seeking me. Did that prove to be true? It did. Problem solved. Right? Then David said to Achish, if I have now found favor in your eyes, let them give me a place in some town in the country that I may dwell there. For why should your servant dwell in the royal city with you? So Achish gave him Ziklag that day, and therefore Ziklag has belonged to the kings of Judah to this day. Now the time David dwelt in the country of the Philistines was 1 full year and 4 months. Call that almost a year and a half. And this happens in just a few verses. Like sometimes the Bible, like, well, what else happened? That. He dwelt there. What does that mean? He lived there. Where? Where's the there? With the Philistines. Calling Achish his boss. I think one of the tougher aspects of David's, I'm going to use this word specifically here. If you're a note taker, you might, if you agree with me, use this word in your notes, despair. One of the tougher aspects of his despair is verse 3. Households are now involved. It's not just him and his family. It's not just him and his soldiers, his men, but their households are now involved. And his despair has now done what? It's led them, and that's a large plurality, led all of them from the land of promise. This is a great leader. Indeed. And what's happened with him speaking in his heart, I'm just not going to make it. I can get away from the land, if I can get away from the land of promise, then I'll get away from Saul. And if I can do that, and if I could get, I know it's over here with the enemy, but at least I will have solved that problem in life. I guess concessions have to be made, even if I'm spending all my time, a year and a half almost, blow by in just a few verses. And what are you doing? Nothing. I'm just dwelling with the enemy. Whew. Here's a great practical question. This is the same Achish, king of Gath, who a few chapters ago, like David had to pretend that he was a crazy person, like the spittle on his beard and scratching at the door. And like, who's this crazy person? So the question now would be, from a real practical standpoint, why would Achish keep David here and now at this point in his life? There's probably three simple answers to this. Number one, apparently, as evidenced by David's actions, they had a common enemy. Who is that? King Saul. Like, this guy is not serving King Saul. He is not in league with the king of Israel. He's been here for all this time. He's come to me again. This guy is not serving the king. We have, or the king of Israel, we have a common enemy. It's Saul. I would think another part of his decision in allowing David, and not only allowing him to be there, but here have an entire city for you and your men, is the impact. This is a small army. This is 600 plus men. Like, that'll do. That'll come in handy, because we've got this common enemy, King Saul. So that, I wonder if I ever need, might need some backup, and 600 men, that's a force to be reckoned with. How about this? I think the third maybe major factor that Achish would say, yeah, not only can you stay, I'm going to give you a whole city. I have no doubt that the weight of all of this, and if you've been with us on Wednesday nights, if you haven't, it's not like go back and listen to the studies, but just go back and read the last 4 to 8 chapters, and just one thing after another with David's life, and it's like everyone suffers, but all of this for David. I imagine that Achish could just see the weight of all of this on the face of David. This man is broken. And for the enemy to look and say, this person's broken, I've got him. This is perfect. Just stay here with me. You don't need to worry about the promise. You don't need to worry about the land. He made you king. You don't have to worry about that. You're never going to get past Saul. And if you stay here, you're going to ensure that you're never going to get past that. Just stay here, and just stay here in your despair. And here, you can even have a city all to yourself. I'll give you a comfortable life outside of the land of promise. And you start to see, man, there's some application there. What despair does to us. Satan, as the story goes, silly story but not, once held a garage sale. And various tools of his trade laid out on several different tables in his front yard. Some of the tools were more common, more familiar. Wrath was there. Anger was there. Bitterness and resentment were there. Petty jealousy, abject hatred, lust, of course, was there. The great tool of apathy, and on all these tools, and people just kind of perusing all these various tools that he'd used on so many for all of human history. And a man was browsing the old tools of the enemy when he noticed a particularly used, well-worn tool. It was different than all the others. And this man asked the accuser about this particular tool. This, answered the enemy. This one. This tool is my most sacred. My tool most oft used, and the greatest in all my tool bag. The man inquired further, and Satan obliged his curiosity by explaining, this tool, this is despair. And by it, many a great warrior, many a wise scholar, and many a humble servant have fallen by its power. The devil, sensing the confusion of this potential customer, as he pulled it from the table of all these other tools, he said to the man, you see, with despair, I can open a wound so deep and yet so subtle that I can then apply at will and with great ease all my other tools on the despairing victim. As the story goes, it said that he pulled despair from the sale, and he yields it effectively to this very day. A person arriving at verse 1 saying to my soul, I'm just never going to get out of this. It's never going to work. There's no hope. There's no end in sight. And since that is true, since there is no hope, there's no end in sight, I should just quit and do something entirely different. I should just go spend my time. I'm going to have my own city with the enemy. That's his conclusion. Again, you want, like, this is David. Like the prodigal son, eventually, when he what? Came to his senses. Like, David, come to your senses. No, I'm just going to be here. And a year and 4 months later, David, how you doing? Same. David, come on. Despair. As I understand this section, and you can dig into this and study it if you'd like, but as I understand it, we have no record of a single psalm of David from this time period. You can dig into that on your own. Like, I know we've referenced some different psalms of his through some different other trials and whatnot, but if I'm not mistaken, this point in his life, not a single psalm is at least, maybe he wrote some, but nothing's recorded. This hurting, broken man, there's no way around it, in his despair, maybe if you're a note taker, you can put this down in your notes, he's not making great choices. That's putting it mildly. So verse 8, here in chapter 27, David and his men, they went up and raided the Geshurites, the Girzites, and the Amalekites, or Amalekites. For those nations were the inhabitants of the land from of old, from ancient times, as you go to Shur, even as far as the land of Egypt. And whenever, verse 9, David attacked the land, he left neither man nor woman alive, but took away the sheep, the oxen, the donkeys, the camels, and the apparel, and returned. And he came to Achish, verse 10. Then Achish would say to him, where have you made a raid today? And David would say, against the southern area of Judah. Wait, is that, am I reading that right? Is David telling the truth there? Not so much. Or against the southern area of this particular group of people, Yerah, Me'elites, or against the southern area of the Kenites, in verse 11, David would save neither man nor woman alive. Why? Because they would bring news to Gath, saying, lest they should be informed on us, saying that thus David did. And thus was his behavior all the time he dwelt in the country of the Philistines. Once again, what do we have for a time reference here? A year and 4 months? What were you doing all that time? Well, I had my own city. Okay, what else were you doing? This. And the word here, fighting or raiding, the Hebrew implies stripping, as in stripping the dead, as you might go through the pockets of a dead man kind of thing. Like, what else is on them? I'm just getting everything I can out of this person, out of this situation, men and women. This is no way for a man after God's own heart to live, but in despair, he is just off track. And maybe he's trying to feel better, almost a, you know, double agent, because you look at, he's attacking these particular groups of people, almost a double agent, but since he gives no indication of being submitted to God, and clearly he's not really serving King Saul, the double agent is like us being really hopeful. So effectively, what is he doing? He's serving self. Which is what you would expect him to do, what you'd expect anyone to do. That's that despairing of life that's given themselves over to the enemy, dwelling with the enemy, and doing the bidding of someone that's trying to save their own skin. He's serving self. David? David. So, verse 12, Achish believed David. Notice what he says, and no doubt in his heart. He's made his people, Israel, utterly abhor him. Therefore, he will be my servant forever. Like, okay. It's one of the more ominous, dun-dun-dun kind of statements. Like, man, what's his tone? Almost like insert evil, maniacal laugh here. I've got him. I've got him. And obviously, it tells us, he believed David. Not only did he believe this, but he had good reason to believe it. No wonder, right? No wonder, along with our minds, we are also to serve God with all of our heart. David, verse 1, he said this in his heart. And no wonder, if you're a note taker, Proverbs chapter 4. Proverbs 4, verse 23, we're told to keep our hearts or to watch over our hearts. I'm sure you're familiar with this passage, Proverbs 4:23. Keep our hearts, watch over our hearts with all diligence. Why? For out of our heart springs the issues of life. And the despair of his heart is bringing forth these issues of his life. I like this in the NIV. Above all else, guard your heart, for everything you do flows from it. David, verse 1, I can't just hammer this home hard enough here. He truly believes that I'm just not making it out of here. I'm never getting past Saul. It's never going to happen. So my best recourse would be spend as much time as I can with the enemy. And again, you look at this, his immediate problem, Saul, well, it's solved. It's solved on this side of the border, but that's the problem, isn't it? You're in the wrong place, dude. His walk with the Lord is... Does he have a walk with the Lord at this point? You sure hope so. Chapter 28, now it happened in those days that the Philistines gathered their armies together for war to fight with Israel. And Achish said to David, you assuredly know that you'll go with me to battle. You and your men, you know this, right? Like, you know this is about to happen a year and 4 months later. Like, we're together. So David said to Achish, surely you know what your servant can do. Like, interesting, he doesn't really say yes, but like, you know what I'm capable of doing, sir. Almost may the king live forever. Like, yeah. So Achish said to David, therefore I will make you one of my chief guardians, not just that you'll be that. You're getting a promotion because you're so good at being my servant, but I'm going to make you that. What's the last word there? Verse 2? Forever? Perpetually, you are going to serve me and you're going to be a promotion in the camp of the enemy. This is almost... What profits a man? Something about gaining the whole world and losing his soul? Something like that, right? You know, like, well, I got a promotion in the enemy's camp. That's not the promotion you want. Now, there's a massive pause button here because the rest of the chapter is devoted to Saul and this super interesting part of his life. And so we've got some time. We should be able to tackle that. And we're not really going to see what's happening after verses 1 and 2 until we arrive at chapter 29, which starts this way. Then the Philistines gathered together and all their armies at Aphek to come against the Israelites. So we're not really going to see that till next week. You're welcome to read ahead. In the meantime, verse 3, now Samuel had died, and all Israel had lamented for him and buried him in Ramah. We've already read this, in his own city. And Saul had put the mediums and the spiritists out of the land. You have to say it. Saul might not be your favorite guy, and there might be certain presidents that aren't your favorite presidents, but every now and then, even not your favorite, sometimes they get it right. And right here with Saul, good job, O king. That's the right thing to do. Good. I might be a slow clap, and why would I be unhappy that he might not be my favorite guy, but he got it right. Like, he got it right. This is, if you're a note taker, this is Leviticus chapters 19 and 20 that deal with some of these things. Like the spiritism and it's occultism. It's like necromancy and whatnot. That's an absolute side note, but I suppose it's an important one. Obviously, right? I don't think I need to say this on a Wednesday night, but Christians should have nothing to do with the occult. Like, we get that. Like, you're like, oh, thank you for that information. We got it. Now, what's interesting to me about verse 3 of chapter 28, the wording here, or maybe the placement in the text, Samuel had died, so he's revisiting what we're told a couple chapters ago. We're told this at the very beginning of chapter 25, and so that had happened a while ago, at least, a year and 4 months ago. And then it says here, and Saul had put the mediums and the spiritists out of the land. In other words, maybe this happened not right here at this chapter 28 point in history, but maybe at this point in Saul's reign, but maybe perhaps when Samuel is still alive, maybe when Samuel died, maybe that's when, we don't know. It might be exactly at this moment. It might have been a year and 4 months earlier. But either way, good job. He didn't get everything wrong all the time. That's an absolute side note too, isn't it? Like, well, I don't like that person. So we tend to assume that if I don't like someone and I don't like, you know, that leader in particular, everything they do is inherently wrong. Not necessarily. Just calm down a little bit. Sometimes even not your favorite people will get some things right. That's a whole other conversation. I absolutely digress at this point. Verse 4. Then the Philistines gathered together and came, and they camped at Shunem. And so Saul gathered all Israel together, and they encamped at Gilboa. When Saul, notice this word once again from Saul, when he saw the army of the Philistines, he was afraid, and his heart trembled greatly. Very similar wording as we saw with Goliath, when the people saw the giant, and when they heard the words of the giant, they were greatly afraid, they're dismayed. And Saul, we're told here, his heart trembled greatly. So at this point, and you can look at a map if you want to dig into this on your own a little bit, this is a strong, aggressive move from the Philistines at this point. It's a side note, but it's always been of interest to me. What are we reading here? Just kind of look at the obvious answer. What are we reading here? It's the army of the Philistines. Okay, got it. That's obvious. But wait, it's the Philistine army? Didn't David, with his victory over Goliath, remember what happened? He's holding up this massive severed head of the giant. And then what did the rest of the Israeli army do? I'm still holding the head, right? What did they see? Like, yeah, let's go get him. And then they routed the Philistines. So, yay. And they all lived happily there. And there was no more problem with the Philistines, except here we are again. I thought the subsequent victory, didn't they put a stop to them? Yep. But the enemy is resilient, isn't he? And the enemy, he keeps fighting. And by the way, this is not just a problem in the days of Saul, but this, keep reading 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel, the Philistines, the enemy will be a problem in David's life later on too. Well, he defeated him the one time. As if we could think there's just one fight and now you could just go kumbaya on your happy way and everything's right, flowers and lollipops. There's still an enemy. He still likes to fight. At any rate, notice verse 5 once again. What happens with Saul when he sees this? He was afraid. There's fear. This is how Saul ruled, and this is what ruled Saul. He ruled by fear, and he was ruled by fear. Verse 6, and when Saul inquired of the Lord Yahweh did not answer him, either by dreams, so the Lord spoken to people in that way in times past, or by Urim, this would be the Urim and the Thummim, the kind of the yes or no answer that would be connected to the priests, or by the prophets. So he's afraid, his heart is trembling greatly, there's a great lack of courage from him, even though he's gathered the army together, the enemy is attacking, and how about this, it gets worse for Saul, now God is silent. Silent. I mean, sometimes for us as believers, man, it feels like, it seems like God's not answering my prayers. He's answering, or he will. It seems like he doesn't even hear me. It seems like my prayers maybe make it to the ceiling, and that's as far as they go. He hears. But Saul, having made himself an enemy of the Lord, this is very much like Samson. Do you remember this in the book of Judges? This is Judges chapter 16 and verse 20. He did not know, do you remember this? He did not know that the Lord, do you remember, had departed from him. Saul, at this point, basically knew that, but in his fear, like, I guess I should pray, and he tries apparently different manners of hearing from the Lord, but nothing. Of course, still needing an answer, verse 7, then Saul said to his servants, find me a woman who is a medium, that I may go to her and inquire of her. Then his servant said to him, this is interesting, in fact, there is a woman who is a medium at Endor. Like, they just knew this. Wait a minute, verse 3. He had removed the mediums and the spiritists, all these wicked things. And yet his people knew, actually, there's a gal, she can help you with that. And so Saul disguised himself and put on other clothes. And he went, and two men with him, and they came to the woman by night, and he said, please conduct a seance for me, and bring up for me the one I shall name to you. What? That? And think about the context here. Okay, so we just talked about this a second ago. I mentioned this is the Philistine army. I thought they were gone, right? Well, no, they didn't go away. And verse 3, he put away all the mediums and spiritists and all this. Apparently, they didn't go away either. Like, oh, just get rid of all the bad stuff and just... like, no, actually, we know a lady. There's a lady, she can help. I'm like, well, let's go. This is still lurking, not quite gone. And here's the textbook detail that I think helps with this. This is just verbatim from Pastor David Guzik, one of my favorites. Traditionally, this woman is known as the Witch of Endor. It may be appropriate to call her a witch, but it's more accurate to call her a medium or a necromancer, one who makes contact with the dead. The Hebrew word for medium is aub, and it has the idea, of mumbling or speaking with a strange, hollow sound as if one were channeling with a dead person speaking through them. The Hebrew word has in mind the sound the channel makes as they speak. The English word medium has in mind the concept of a channel. They stand in between the world of the living and the dead and communicate between the two worlds. Wait, what? Yeah, we shouldn't be messing with any of this kind of stuff. And again, verse 3, good job, man, get rid of that stuff. We don't need that in the land. Correct. But hey, kind of in a bit of a squeeze here. Can we see, I know we got rid of everybody, but surely there's someone still. Yeah, sir, we can take care of that. So Saul, what's happening? Verse 8 is quite telling. I'm sure you caught this, even by just me reading it in your own eyes looking at the text. He disguised himself. He goes with a small party, just gets a couple other guys, and he goes under cover of darkness. He goes by night. What would you assume he's trying to do here? Wednesday night people, what would you assume? Something nefarious, great word, thank you. I didn't even get nefarious, good. He's trying to keep this hidden, secret. I need people to not know what's happening because this is actually pretty shameful. Not only shameful, but, oh, maybe this is an appropriate word at this point. Maybe a little bit, hypocritical? Get rid of all those people. By the way, if anyone's still floating around, the people that we removed from land, I'd like to speak with that person immediately, if not sooner. Like, well, this is the classic terrible leadership, which is not leadership. Do as I say, not as I do. By the way, another side note to this. This is Leviticus chapter 20 and verse 6, where God promises to set his face against the person. God promises to cut them off from his people, the person who turns to mediums or spiritists. And this is rough stuff because Saul, already having the kingdom removed from... Think about this. I know it's getting late and it's like... keep going here. Just follow me here for another few minutes. But already having the kingdom removed from him, he's running headlong to further destruction. Like, dude, at some point, just stop, man. You've made so many poor choices. You have brought ruin to your own life, your own family. You've done this. Just stop, dude. God's not talking to me, so I better turn the exact opposite direction. This takes me back to Romans chapter 1 all over again. Reject God and resist truth, and resist God and reject truth, and what remains? Error and falsehood. That's all that remains for him. So they go to her. He says, please conduct, there in verse 8 again, please conduct a seance for me and bring up for me the one I shall name to you. Then the woman, verse 9, said to him, look, you know what Saul has done, how he has cut off the mediums and the spiritists from the land. Why then do you lay a snare for my life to cause me to die? Is this a smart lady? Is she being savvy? Perhaps, but here's the problem. She too knows the truth, and she too knows the danger of such a lifestyle, but she's practicing it anyways. Like, I know the king outlawed this, but I'm just going to keep on doing what I want to do. Thank you very much. Like, just, is this some kind of a trap? I kind of don't care because this is my lifestyle. Like, you want her to be some kind of, it's not in favor of her either. So verse 10, notice this. Don't miss this. Saul swore to her, prepositional phrase, by the all caps Lord covenant name of God Yahweh. He swore to her in the name of Yahweh. Who? Yahweh earlier when he inquired of him, verse 6, Yahweh didn't speak. He's now swearing to this medium who should not even be in the land by the name of the Lord. Like, dude, where are you? Saying the right things, but so off track. I'm always worried about some praise the Lord kind of things from people that are clearly not even intent on the Lord. Swore to her by the Lord, saying, as the Lord lives, no punishment shall come upon you for this thing. And interestingly enough, as the king, he has the authority to make such a statement. I promise by the Lord that I'm not going to do anything to you. Going against his own established verse 3, ruling and command. What a mess. I have no other thing to say about Saul other than this is so sad. Then the woman said, well, whom shall I bring up for you? And he said, bring up Samuel for me. Okay. He's dead. When the woman saw Samuel, she cried out with a loud voice, which I will not imitate. And the woman spoke to Saul, saying, why have you deceived me for your Saul? Like, how could you do such a thing? You know, like, as though she's the good guy here. And the king said to her, don't be afraid. What did you see? And the woman said to Saul, I saw a spirit ascending out of the earth. Okay. So he said to her, what is his form? And she said, an old man is coming up, and he is covered with a mantle. And Saul perceived that it was Samuel, and he stooped with his face to the ground and bowed down. You know, there's some unexpected history in the Bible. Again, these aren't just stories or legends. This actually happened. And there's probably 100 questions here, or maybe it's just one or two of the same variety of questions. Here's your couple of questions. Is this Samuel? Because if the answer is yes, then how? What? What's happening? If the answer is no, then who? What? What is? Why? What is? I don't understand. Neither do I. Look at some of the details here. She cries, and it seems legitimate. There seems to be legitimate terror, because you'd almost expect from some of these things, you know, these are tricks or almost parlor tricks, you know. And up to this point, if that's the case, if this were just trickery on her up to this point in her career, maybe this is, she's finally seeing something genuinely supernatural. Like, she's freaking out, I don't know what the Hebrew is for freaking out, but well, maybe it's this. Like, she cried out, right? Just, she's not expecting what she sees. It seems absolutely legitimate. So wait a minute, if there is something happening here and she's the one that's used by this, and by the way, why would the Lord not allow for mediums and spiritists and necromancy? Because there's something to it. And why would people return to this if there was nothing to it? I'm reminded, of course, of Pharaoh. Think Exodus chapter 7, where his wise men performed the same supernatural works that Moses did. Well, what? How about this? This is the best way I can explain it. The enemy is an imposter, but he has certain power. So maybe they're not tricks with her. Maybe she's familiar with the demonic, but maybe she's not familiar with the Hallowed. So again, all right, is this Samuel? Verse 14 says, Saul perceived that it was Samuel, so he believes it is. Verse 15, now Samuel said. Verse 16, then Samuel said. Fast forward to verse 20. Immediately Saul fell full length on the ground and was dreadfully afraid because the words of Samuel. So you still haven't answered the question, what is this? Who is this? I'll give you five quick possibilities of who this is, and I'll just tell you my opinion. I lean towards Samuel. Really? Really, I do. This is also, if you're a note taker, Luke chapter 16, the rich man and Lazarus, as in this is pre-cross, rich man and Lazarus and Samuel, not in heaven yet, so who is this? If it's not Samuel, here's some other concepts or other things that other people have suggested. Is this a hallucination? That doesn't seem to fit. Number one, it doesn't say anything like that, but it doesn't explain her immediate fear or the clarity, as we'll read in just a moment, the clarity of the message. By the way, it's an absolute side note. I'm looking at the clock here too, but the funny thing with this kind of thing, We get so excited about what's the thing here, and we tend to lose sight of the message that tends to be the important. Like, I gotta know what it is. So hallucination, I'm gonna suggest probably not. Is it a deception by her? Again, this is hard to believe on the basis of what we're actually told. Samuel spoke to Saul, and the result of all these things, where Saul was familiar with Samuel's voice, also she seems legitimately afraid by this, and deception on her part would not produce fear like this in her unless that was just part of the act. That's part of the deception, but we're not told that. There's no wording to indicate mere deception. Is it possible, and some have suggested this, maybe she had an accomplice? You know, someone outside the tent, if there's a tent, maybe hiding behind the tree, and like just put on a cloak and just rising from, like, I see an old man, like, up with a mantle. Quick, get a mantle. I don't know. But have you ever watched, you know, some magician's tricks? And like, he just saw that lady in half house, and like, oh, actually, there's two people. Oh. And when you get the behind the scenes look, it's like, oh, that's no trick at all. Like, really cool looking, but there's nothing nefarious, thank you very much, about that. It's just a really good trick, except that also doesn't seem to be the case, and there's zero textual evidence to support that as an accomplice. How about this? Some would have definitely suggested, well, this is just simply demonic because the activity in which she's employed is demonic. A familiar spirit, these spiritists, or a spirit guide masquerading, this is what they suggest, it's masquerading as Samuel, and demons, fallen angels, being outside of time, you know what they know? They know a lot of stuff. They know information from history. They know facts. They know details. And they know details of our lives. They know details of our past. So they would have known certain things about Samuel. And is it possible that this is, what else does the Bible call this? A lying spirit? Is it possible? It's actually possible that it's that. It just doesn't seem, because the wording doesn't indicate that, that it would be this. Or it's actually Samuel. And so I'll give you a Pastor Chuck Smith quote on this, my old pastor. Now, did Samuel really come back? Did this witch actually bring back a spirit from the dead? I would like to say I see no reason at all for not believing the story just as it is written. I always feel that the obvious interpretation is the correct interpretation. If you try to force another interpretation into the text, that actually the very fact that you're trying to force something means it doesn't fit. I do not understand this whole issue, but I am convinced that even as it is written, so it happened, and that somehow Samuel did come back. And do what you want with this. So that aside, and you spend all this time on it, like, okay, so what's the message? That's the primary point of the account. Verse 15, now Samuel said to Saul, why have you disturbed me by bringing me up? And Saul, now he's speaking with him, and Saul answered, I'm deeply distressed because the Philistines make war against me, and God's departed from me and does not answer me anymore, neither by prophets nor by dreams. Therefore, I've called you that you may reveal to me what I should do. I have no idea what to do. Then Samuel said, verse 16, so why do you ask me, seeing the Lord has departed from you and has become your enemy? Like, if the Lord's not, why do you expect this from me? That's a good question. And the Lord, by the way, if this is a demonic kind of thing, why is it going to be so forthright with Saul? So why have you asked this? And the Lord has done for himself, verse 17, as he spoke by me, for the Lord has torn the kingdom out of your hand and given it to your neighbor David. Because you did not obey the voice of the Lord, nor execute his fierce wrath upon Amalek. Therefore, the Lord has done this thing to you this day. Verse 19, moreover, the Lord will also deliver Israel with you into the hand of the Philistines. You're going to lose. And tomorrow, you and your sons will be with me. The Lord will also deliver the army of Israel into the hand of the Philistines. Wow. Again, why would a lying spirit or this woman provide such a message? She's probably like, oh, this is the king? Oops, I need to give him something a little more flowery than that. Why would she do this? And if this is actually legitimate, you might keep reading, you know, will this come to pass? And the answer would provide a clearer picture of the validity of this message. So having heard this, immediately, verse 20, Saul fell full length on the ground and was dreadfully afraid because of the words of Samuel. There was no strength in him, for he had eaten no food all day or night. And I think for Saul, this message from Samuel, like his situation, the reality, it's finally, how do we say this? Like, it's finally caught up to him, right? Like, here it is, dude, there's no getting away from this. And the despair on your heart and the trembling of your heart, it's for good reason. It's like the weight of this, it's the crushing depths of the ocean, kind of just this weight all on his heart. Here's the reality of your situation. And the woman, so he's just on the ground. The woman came to Saul and saw that he was severely troubled and said to him, "Look, your maidservant has obeyed your voice." And I'm using my own tone here, but, "and I've put my life in your hands and heeded the words which you spoke me. You promised not to kill me, even though I'm not supposed to be doing what I do, but you've promised this." I don't really think she's that interested in helping him. Verse 22, "Now therefore, please heed also the voice of your maidservant and let me set a piece of bread before you and eat." That seems nice. Why? "So that you may have strength and go your way." Like, dude, please get out of here. Like, what? "Do you need something? I'll be happy to give you something so you can please be just gone. Thank you. Just please." But he refused and said, "I will not eat." And so his servants, the guys that joined him, together with the woman, urged him, and he heeded their voice. And then he arose from the ground, sat on the bed, and she's probably like, "Come on." The woman had a fatted calf in the house, and she hastened to kill it. And she took flour and kneaded it and baked. That was the quickest meal she's ever baked. Right, baked unleavened bread from it. And so she brought it before Saul and his servants, and they ate. And then they arose and went away that night. It was too late for Saul, but you sure hope after, this is just me and my conjecture here, after he departs that this woman examines her life and examines her choices and examines her life choices and begins to amend her ways. I would think, like, this is too real, this is too serious, and if the Lord's doing that to the king and I'm breaking the laws of God necromancer, I should probably repent. We're not told that she does. This is just the hope in me that would say, "Come on, lady." And my hope is because it's not too late. You've still got breath in your lungs. It's not too late. It's not too late to turn. It's not too late to turn from the... But all these things I've done, it's not too late to turn. Not too late. Thanks for being here. Keep reading. See you next week.